Hey there, everybody. I'm doing another special episode, not quite one of the catching up with a previous guest, because really, I was a guest on someone else's podcast, and then we did some more recording. So about a year ago, and I'm embarrassed about this because I let this lie for a long time. I was on Dan Smith's podcast, Coffee and Space. We had a great discussion, and then we stayed on the line and continued recording, thinking that I could drop something into my feed eventually if it made sense. And at that point, I wasn't really doing the Comfort Reads episodes anymore that I had been doing, and so I just kind of let it fall by the wayside and left it untouched ever since. And Dan reached out to me recently and said, hey, whatever happened to that? So I went back and listened through to the conversation. And I think it's a great conversation. And so we talk about apocalyptic fiction and a project that he's working on. And we kind of talk about the genre as a whole, a little bit of, you know, the whys of the popularity of apocalyptic fiction and my inability to pronounce apocalyptic. And then we also give some recommendations for reading in the genre. So I hope you enjoy it. I'm going to go ahead and turn you over to Seth and Dan from 2022. So I am very pleased to welcome Dan Smith from Coffee and Space on. Hi there, Dan.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Originally, we were talking about maybe doing a Comfort Reads episode on like detective fiction, right?
Yeah, old school crime novels, the noir, the hard-boiled stuff, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But instead, you said, hey, how about something more science fiction related? And you mentioned that you kind of had a project you were working on about apocalyptic fiction. So why don't you talk about that? And actually, before we get to that, talk about Coffee and Space.
Oh, yeah. First of all, really, truly, thanks for reciprocating the invite. I appreciate it. I've liked your podcast. I like what you do with it. And
thanks, man. And
so I'm happy to be here. So yeah, Coffee and Space is a podcast that seeks to introduce listeners to authors and books that they don't yet know they love. That's kind of the tagline there. So so anything from names that you'd recognize like Andy Weir, C. Robert Cargill, and folks like that to debuts that you wouldn't recognize but they have good books coming out or books that have really neat concepts. And so I have the authors on in almost every case. And we talk about their book, their world building, characterization, how they build the plot out, a little bit into editing, but mostly about the development of the story. And then, you know, talk about how to get it and things like that. We try to come out really close to or on the release date of the book. And then the other thing I'll do is like a science behind the science fiction type of podcast episode where I'll have a scientist, a physicist, or I've had a cyber psychologist on before. I've had someone who works at, not JPL, but it's a different, it's a NASA arm, in their aerospace division, just to talk about things relating to the fiction that we read all the time and enjoy. And I think your listeners probably would latch onto that. So we do those two types of things. We'll either have authors on to talk about their books or we'll have some scientists on to talk about the fact behind the fiction.
Nice. Yeah. You recently had one of the physicist kind of episodes where you're talking about lasers and space elevators and stuff.
Yeah.
That was great.
Dr. Charles Adler, he was awesome because I've always wondered about lasers in space and that's what's neat about the podcast is I kind of get to find out the things that I want to know about. You know, I want to know how psychology works in the cyber world. I want to know how, if it is ever possible, how faster than light travel would work. And so I get to kind of work on lasers in space and things like that. I can't say lasers without doing Mike Myers, but.
Right. laser beams.
Lasers. and I realize no one can see that video. But anyway, so those types of things are really neat. And then just getting to talk about books with an author. I'm an aspiring writer too, and it's just a lot of fun.
Yeah. That's I find it really inspiring when I come across other podcasters who are just like taking the big swing, going after authors. And you know, I think you're small time kind of like I am, you know, just like I'm just a dude on the internet sending this email hoping that you'll get back to me. And it's really cool.
Yeah, and it goes both ways. You know, I was shocked when Andy Weir's publicist wrote back and said he was on board. I couldn't believe it, you know, and some others of that kind of level. And I've not been shocked when people have ignored me either. And, you know, because I do know where I'm at right now. And so I just take what I get.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool content. And I mean, it makes me think I could start doing, I mean, there's a lot of like authors who are Hugo winners who are still alive and I could reach out to, which would be cool.
Yep.
We'll see. Okay. So let's talk about the project that I mentioned earlier.
Yeah, so something that's always fascinated me, and it goes back to some of the early science fiction and religious writings that I've read throughout my life, is the apocalypse and apocalyptic style of writing, primarily in the fiction world and science fiction. I've really enjoyed it. I confess I don't necessarily enjoy dystopian fiction. So if you go into the world has fallen apart, and no one likes how things are, I don't really like that type of writing necessarily as much as I like the more immediate aftermath of the apocalyptic event. So like, for example, Neville Shute's On the Beach, where the, you know, they're kind of huddled down in Australia waiting for the radiation to get to them.
Right.
Which isn't necessarily scientifically accurate, but it made for a great story. And so it's, you know, apocalypse has happened. What's the immediate aftermath of it? That type of story has always kind of intrigued me. And so what I've wondered is about myself and about others, because it's a fairly popular style subgenre, if you will, of science fiction.
Yeah.
Why is it? Why do we like the thought of being miserable? Why do we like the thought, particularly in the Western world and developing countries? Why do we like the idea of all these creature comforts being taken away? You know, I mean, you and I are recording this thing. We're not even on the same coast. And, you know, that would be gone if there was EMP blast from nuclear blast. Why do I like that? And so I've just tried to kind of figure it out. I've started engaging researchers on it, and I've started compiling lists of books. And so, you know, long story short, that's what the project is. It's trying to understand why we like apocalyptic fiction and what that says about us.
Nice.
And so, so that's kind of the driving force behind it. I've been working on the book proposal now, and done some blog writing and then having authors on to talk about their stories.
Cool. Yeah. So just, listener, this episode is just, we're just going to be talking about apocalyptic fiction and, you know, titles that we'd recommend, and talk a little bit about the why. I do want to talk about the dystopian trend at some point, during the discussion, but you and I are of a, you know, similar generation. And I don't know. For me, I think one of the fascinations with apocalyptic fiction is I just assumed that we were going to have a nuclear war in my lifetime when I was growing up. It just felt close. I don't know if it was the same for you.
Yeah. So I was, you know, I was born in 77. So admittedly, the closer to the tail end as I became aware, like, in 1983, in my research, I've learned that we were actually fairly close during something called Operation Able Archer. 83, the Russians themselves had had a scare a few months before this exercise, where a commander in a bunker had to turn off the nuclear launch because their satellites told them we were attacking.
Right.
And so they had had a scare, and then during Able Archer, it looked like we were attacking them because the exercise was so real. I was oblivious to all of that. In 83, I was, you know, 6 years old, give or take. And so I didn't know that. Towards the latter end of the real tail end of the Cold War, I remember the Berlin Wall coming down, as I know you do. And the Kasparovs, no, that's not the Carpathian, maybe, and the Romanian leaders at the time. I remember seeing pictures of them dead in the streets as their rebellion started. The coup. So I remember those things. And so at that time, you know, we had all of our missiles pointed at Russia. Russia had all their missiles pointed at us. I didn't realize until later how close, particularly in 1983, and then particularly in the Bay of Pigs, which was before my time, that we actually were close on a couple of occasions to trading nuclear weapons.
I mean, so with that context, you can certainly see that it makes sense that that would be on the mind of authors, right?
Yeah.
And it's super, super common when you go back to early science fiction to just, you know, assume that everything is going to be atomic in the future, that you know, the atom has recently been split, right? And so science fiction in the 50s is all about, well, we're going to be using atomics for this and atomics for that, and you know, atomic hair dryers and you know, all that kind of thing. And then kind of as the reality of, well, we could blow ourselves to hell with this, then I feel like that is when you got more of the fiction that's like, well, what would happen? What would that be like? And I've always thought about this, and you know, tell me if I'm stealing your thunder here. when I've thought about it myself, you know, thinking about something like The Terminator, or even when I was a kid, The Day After was a big television event, right? We watched it in my high school. And at least I think we did. I'll have to check on the date of that. That's my memory of it, but memory is notoriously fallible.
Yeah. The older terrifying. I get, the more I learn that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And but I think there's also that little thing in your head is like, but I could handle it. I could, you know, I can measure myself against that and go, yeah, I'm up to it. And I think you can only really ask yourself that question when you feel like it's real.
Yeah, I agree with you. You talk about in that term, those terms, the things that you had remembered. And same thing for me when I read, On the Beach by Neville Shoot. I was like, I had already wanted to be in the Navy, even as an early, in my early years. I just assumed I was going into the Navy. So yeah, I even had a more military a background to the fiction that I was enjoying or dreaming in my own head as a aspiring writer. I wanted to be a writer even back then. But yeah, so it had a military part in it. You know, I was like, oh, I could have been that commander. And his name escapes me right now. That's the commander in On the Beach. I could do that. Mm-hmm. I could lead a submarine after a nuclear war. I could try and reestablish some kind of communication with the homeland and whatnot. And I think there's a little bit of heroism or perceived heroics that go into that type of story.
Yeah. I just looked it up. The Day After came out in 1983. So I probably honestly watched it on television with my parents. Yeah. But I seem to remember that we did watch it in high school.
Oh, too. Yeah. So that was another thing. I remember that. That's another thing that happened in 83 that made everything kind of shaky that year.
Yeah.
And definitely informed attitudes and perceptions about what was going on in the world.
Yeah. And that is kind of where, when you think about the dystopian trend, right? Because if you go to Barnes & Noble, if you can find one, the one nearest us just closed.
Yeah.
You know, there's a whole section of young adult fiction and so much of it is dystopian. And it always made me wonder, like, why is this what appeals? And I think as the fears of like nuclear obliteration fell off, we had to think about what else scares us, you know? And so societal upheaval, you know, the social apocalypse became more real.
Yeah, and I think it's easy to attach that to the other thing that's going on right now. And it doesn't matter what side of the argument someone falls on or how much or to what degree they believe in climate change.
But right.
I think it makes it easy to add climate change as a driver of that dystopian nightmare. The climate's fallen apart. Cities have been overrun and washed out. Governmental and societal standards fall away.
Yeah.
So the thing that you and I grew up with that happened in a matter of seconds,
right?
You know, as the nuclear blast happened all over the world, is 100 years or more in the making, and they even honestly include evolutionary biological changes to the human makeup in many of these stories. You know, suddenly, you know, you have almost an urban fantasy tie-in where, you know, someone has powers that they shouldn't have because of some, you know, biological change.
Yeah.
And I think that probably still feeds the same thing that you and I grew up thinking, you know, that there's an opportunity to, you know, make our mark. You know, teenagers aren't very much different. They have cooler devices now than you and I did when we were kids. But the reality is we still want to make our mark on the world, and we still think we know more than most adults do. Mm-hmm. And so when the adults let the world crash down around them, it makes for an easy YA novel, I think, especially in a dystopian world.
Yeah. It's interesting to me to think about, you know, when we were kids without all the devices and everything, I feel like, and maybe this is just a Gen Xer looking down his nose at you know, Gen Z, being like, you know, if everything came crashing down, if there was an EMP or like in the 5 seconds after, is that what that book's called? I can't remember if that's what it is. If all the devices shut down, right? In our time, we'd been like, okay, well, I guess we can't use our phones, but our phones were landlines, right? And so if they didn't work, you know, our other method of communication was to hop on our bike and ride over to our buddy's house. I don't know. I feel like we were maybe more capable of dealing with that, and it would be a tougher blow to handle now, even for me, right? In my current level of, you know, connectedness, if that was all taken away, it would be much harder to adjust to than it would have been in the 80s.
Yeah, I think even as a parent, I don't know how old your kids are or whatever, but my kids, I got an 18, a 16, and a 9-year-old, and all of them, the youngest doesn't have a cell phone yet, but like they all have devices.
Yeah.
And I use those devices myself to know where they are.
Right.
You know, and so, yeah, if an EMP blast took that away and my kids were somewhere else, I'd be...
Oh, that'd be horrible.
I'd be in a different place.
Yeah.
Because it was also, the attitude back then was, you know, when the streetlights come on, come home. So if there was some kind of apocalypse moment, you know, the understanding was you may not see your family again.
Right.
And so... So how would that affect me as a parent now if there was some nuclear, and people do still periodically revisit the nuclear war, but the driver for dystopia and apocalyptic fiction. Every now and then a book will come out or a short story.
Yeah. I feel like that's important though, because like the idea that we're out of the woods with possible nuclear annihilation is a mistake.
It is. And the number of ways to get it triggered is growing. Or it's, I don't know if it's like growing every day, but like there are still several options for that type of apocalypse to take place. We don't think of it. We've got other things to worry about, you know, particularly in the time period that you and I are talking right now with pandemics and whatnot. But which is another driver of apocalyptic fiction, a dystopian fiction. But yeah, nuclear fiction's still out there. Nuclear weapons are still out there.
Yep. And that's, you know, to say nothing of chemical or biological
warfare. Yeah, which gets revisited every now and then as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the thing about like a bioweapon or a chemical weapon is, whereas nuclear could wipe out hundreds of millions of people in literally an instant. Mm-hmm. Those weapons, you got to fire a whole lot more of them to do the same level of damage. On the other hand, a bioweapon could keep spreading after the fact and you could have the death for a long time. So, you know, again, that kind of gets into the why. Why am I interested in that? Why are we as a people interested in that? Because it's like, I mean, why would I sit around and dream up ways that bioweapons could keep spreading?
Right.
That's just, you know, but we do as authors, as readers, it's just something that we enjoy.
Yeah. I mean, have you thought about that from you personally?
From the writing perspective, like why do we do that?
Like why you personally?
Why I do? Yeah, and I think a lot of it is the military background that I have growing up. I had grandfathers in World War II, both sides of the family. I had my dad was in Vietnam in the Navy. I knew from a young age that it was expected that I was going to join the military, so that was a kind of an easy tie-in. And then like with David Brin's The Postman, you know, the idea of picking society back up, you know, after, which is actually closer to dystopian than apocalyptic fiction anyway. In fact, it just flat out is. But you know, I used to dream of being that guy, you know, that was going to like the postman. I was going to be the postman, man, you know, I mean, you know, not to play too much off of it. But, you know, there's the heroics in there that with a lot fewer people. The opportunity for heroics raises substantially for normal dudes like me who probably aren't going to be heroes.
Right.
You know, I mean, just like getting down brass tacks.
Yeah.
I'm not a guy who's going to have opportunities to go be a hero. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about the, oh, thank you for your service. You're a hero type of thing, or you're a school teacher. So, you know, you're a hero to kids. You know, I'm talking about hero, like Captain America style hero.
Right.
I'm not going to be that guy, you know, but I like reading about that guy, you know, like the postman or the submarine that's in on the beach, or even Canico for Leibowitz, which I just revisited on my last Navy deployment. The restarting a part of society when everything has fallen apart, when all the powers that be messed it all up and I've got a chance to fix things. And maybe even rewrite things in a way that I think they should have been in the first place. I think probably speaks to something in my head that I'm still trying to figure out.
Yeah. I was thinking about this and, you know, kind of after you presented the idea of talking about apocalyptic fiction. And I have such a hard time saying apocalyptic and saying getting it right every time.
It's a big word.
It is.
It really is.
Yeah.
With a lot of weird consonants.
Yeah. And I was thinking about, I think I was thinking about this in context of the Hugo Awards, actually, from our previous discussion, thinking about themes and thinking about a lot of science fiction can be a little pessimistic, and a lot of it is optimistic. You know, you have kind of a balance. And so you have something like even Star Trek, right? Star Trek The Next Generation talks about the post-atomic horror, right? The atomic wars that happened. And then out of that, you end up with this wonderful utopian society, right? And even something like A Canticle for Leibowitz, it's got both sides to it as well, because it's definitely pessimistic about the fact that we're going to just bomb ourselves out of oblivion, and then we're going to crawl out of those ashes and try and retain and preserve as much knowledge as we can so that we can rebuild society, at which point we're probably going to blow ourselves to hell again. And just this kind of cycle that's going on there. I'm like, okay, that's a little depressing. And, you know, kind of at the end of that one, is that the one where they're on a rocket leaving Earth?
Yeah. They have to leave because the whole thing's happening all over
again. Right. And you just wonder, is it going to go better in the new place?
Yeah. And I think he alludes a little bit to it. The fact is, there's a statement in recovery programs that say, everywhere I go, there I am. Mm. Meaning you can't escape the sick person. You have to just deal with the sick person. And so I think, I think that we seem to have a penchant for finding ways to hurt each other, to cause problems in our society. We seem to not want a utopia. We can say we do, but we don't act like it. You know, our actions speak louder in words in that case. And I think of some of the other types of like robot uprising type things, because that's another form of apocalyptic fiction. Where, you know, runaway AI or machines that rise up, and you know, the Matrix, the C. Robert Cargill's Day Zero and Sea of Rust. Mm. And I'm trying to think of some others off the top
Terminator,
of my head, but the Terminator, of course. Yeah, we were just talking about all these things where, you know, even in Terminator 2, when they try and explain to the guy, you can't use that arm to rebuild your cybernetics because that leads us to death. It's hard to walk away from it. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, I feel like I'm getting off track, and I apologize for that. There's just something in there. Yes, it is pessimistic, but think about it, particularly in military fiction. Let's take Terminator, for example. The whole premise of Terminator is that somehow they also develop technology strong enough and good enough to send a protector back in time to take care of John Connor so that he survives to become the leader of the resistance.
Yeah.
So even in this pessimistic world that has been created because we allowed the AI and the machines to rise and to supplant us as the dominant species, it also still created these, you know, we found ways to have to work around it, to use that technology still. And so there's still, I think there's positives. It just also really is easy to see the human condition in apocalyptic and dystopian type of fiction.
It is. Yeah. Well, and even when you look at stuff like, have you ever read Alas, Babylon by Pat Frank?
I haven't read it yet. It's on my list.
Okay. Do you ever see the television show Jericho?
I have.
Okay. It's essentially the same story.
Okay.
It's just in Florida instead of in Kansas. But it's the same kind of thing where like a nearby metropolitan center is hit with a nuke, and that's all they know, right? Because the information and it's, you know, it's set in the 50s. So there's even less information than you would get now if you had, somebody with a hardy laptop like they did in Jericho. But it's the same kind of thing where it's the apocalypse that happens is just the setting for the story. And after that, it's, you know, how do we survive and what kind of people survive? And you have different kind of things that happen there, right? You have the groups that are willing to work together for the common good, and you have the people who are just willing to go around and do whatever it takes and take from other people. Bill Burr, comedian, one time was talking about preppers, and he said, all you're doing is collecting stuff for stronger people. And I'm like, okay, that's really pessimistic. But on the other
hand, really pessimistic. Yeah. It's also probably true. In fact, it comes out a lot in dystopian fiction that someone, you know, you find you raid a former prepper's stuff where they're already dead, or you kill them and take their stuff. That is a common theme. It's in all the way back in the canticle for Leibowitz has it in there, where there's a power vacuum, obviously, after the war. And then these individuals step into it. What becomes the Catholic Church tries to maintain a desire for knowledge and protection of knowledge and information. But then they immediately sense that this power vacuum is going to create a problem for the knowledge that they have, if it falls into the wrong hands. David Brin does a really great job with the warlords that are in The Postman. All these, several of these stories have that common theme or that trope, I guess, if you will, of someone stepping into the power vacuum that's going to happen after society has broken down, after government has gone away. It's what we know, you know, we're tribal and whatnot. And so, so it is interesting to explore that concept as well.
Yeah. Even like Mad Max, right? Where you have the,
absolutely.
The places that have the oil, the places that have the bullets, right? They become centers that are important.
Yeah, it really is that way. And I think it's okay to explore that because it allows us, you know, on one hand, those of us everyday people, you know, it's kind of a, see, this is what the man's going to do to us. They're going to lead us in this way that's going to go down a bad place. And if, whether it's atomic weapons or if it's, you know, climate fiction that they, you know, where they fail to regulate carbon emissions or whatnot on a global scale or whatever the case they want to do, robot uprisings, it doesn't matter. The, you know, the powers that be currently are leading us in the wrong direction. And when that power is gone, someone else is going to step into that power and misuse it as well. I mean, Walking Dead.
Yeah.
You know, you have power struggles in things where people literally should just be bonding together and trying to survive.
Right.
And even there you have, and that's part of what the drama is, right? It's when someone steps in and decides to take power.
Yeah.
So again, we're talking pessimistically. There does seem to be a lot of pessimistic elements of apocalypse and dystopia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's fair to call it pessimistic, but some of it, I'm just like, that's just it's the reality of the history of us as a species.
Yeah, I mean, it's borne out. Mm-hmm. You know, there's precedent set. We tend to misuse each other and take power from each other.
Yep. So. I often joke.
So I think one of the things that I'm working on in the project, you know, it's kind of the last chapter or two is, and it came out of an episode I did on my podcast where I had Calder Shevchuk on. It's actually two writers who write under a common pen name. They took each other's last name for the pen name, and they talk about problematizing the issues of climate fiction in their you know, their dystopia to try and set, not just sound the alarm, sound the warning, like a lot of old nuclear apocalyptic fiction did, that, you know, if we misuse these weapons, it's really going to go badly.
Yeah.
But to try and give people the impetus to change their personal thinking about it. And I think that might be a way that we take the pessimistic attitudes inherent in the writing of dystopian and apocalyptic, post-apocalyptic fiction, and try and find a thing to be optimistic about in our current life.
Right.
And so, you know, my project focuses a little bit on what that problematizing looks like and what, you know, if a step could be to utilize that information as best we could. Mm-hmm. And so I haven't fleshed that out yet. Like I said, this is a project still in process, obviously, but
yeah.
But there are, I think, are options for optimism in the future. I mean, the Cold War did end. And while, like you and I mentioned earlier, I can't remember if it was before taping or not, but, you know, those nukes are still pointed at people.
Yeah.
But and there are third parties that have access to nuclear weaponry and nuclear power that maybe shouldn't.
Yeah.
The chances are drastically reduced. And I think a lot of that might have been because of some of the fiction that came out from the 60s through the 80s.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's an important point, right? That the role of the science fiction author in particular, right, is to shine a light, sometimes by using the future on our present situation and say, hey, here's where we could end up if we go down this direction. And like you had mentioned recovery programs, right? You could see that, like, in the Star Trek timeline, that nuclear war is kind of the way that humanity hits rock bottom and starts the road to recovery.
I agree. And so, like, Star Trek, which I love dearly, mm-hmm. I really, in fact, I kind of wish there were things in Star Trek that there aren't, and it's not built to be, you know, as a military man, I would like it to, you know, I want to know more about the Romulan Wars, that they're just not going to develop more because that's not what Star Trek's about. But there are, I think there are options there. But anyway, I love Star Trek. So that's one way that people can view how humanity is going to handle a massive worldwide nuclear war, whatever apocalypse you want to go with now. And then, of course, there's Canticle for Leibowitz, which, you know, posits that we're just going to do it again once we get the knowledge back. So there are different ways of looking at it. I think all of them are important. One of the guests that I had on my podcast at one point is a climatologist, and he only studies how radiation and nuclear winter will affect the climate. So he's he doesn't actually do, you know, global warming and that type of climate work. You'd almost, if you didn't know that there were still tons of nukes pointed at various countries, you would think that he doesn't have a reason to exist anymore.
Right.
But his whole purpose was to sound the alarm that this isn't just going to kill a couple hundred million people when Moscow, New York, DC, London, and Paris are off the map. We're talking about the nuclear winter and 5 years of 0 degree weather that's going to spread across the world with the ash and all that. And so, you know, it's not just fiction writers that try and sound that alarm, that show what rock bottom is going to look like. Mm-hmm. There was an entire group of scientists also working on this to, you know, you talk about that rock bottom, to show what that rock bottom is going to look like. And that if there's, and that's the other thing about recovery. If there's any way to prevent rock bottom, try and prevent rock bottom.
Right.
You know, enter recovery earlier, get your help for your family member, your loved one earlier, if you can. Rock bottom really sucks.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's these scientists, there are writers, like the ones we've mentioned, like several of the Hugo winners or the Hugo nominees who have written about it, speaking to your podcast, to try and sound that alarm, to give an optimistic message that we can make these changes. And I think that's part of what I'm learning through this project, is that there is opportunity to change.
Yeah.
Sorry to preach too much there, but.
No worries. So, like, if you wanted to recommend a survey of apocalyptic fiction, do you have any titles that you want to recommend? Other than, I mean, obviously we've mentioned a few already.
Yeah, no, we've mentioned some great ones. You know, the aforementioned Canticle for Leibowitz, there's The Postman that we've talked about. There's another great book. David Brin actually recommended this to me once, Stand on Zanzibar.
Oh, yeah.
Which is another one of those classics. Mm-hmm. Kim Stanley Robinson has done a ton of work in, particularly in climate fiction,
right?
But climate fiction as dystopia, and not all the world has fallen apart and there's no government left. Right. He actually often, I think this is what's refreshing about it. Even if I don't agree with everything he writes, no one does agree with everything a writer writes, but, regardless of that, Kim Stanley Robinson's books, New York 2140 comes to mind. He wrote a book about Aurora, which is actually about a generation ship, but they come back.
Right.
And in Hong Kong, to get around Hong Kong, you can't do it on ground anymore because Hong Kong as a island doesn't exist. And so that's what he purports in the novel. So I recommend those books too, because it shows how society is going to function after it's really during the apocalyptic event of a slow moving apocalyptic event. So I recommend, I love nuclear fiction. So the things we've already talked about, The Last Ship is also a good one. Not the show, although the show is good. I enjoyed particularly the first season of The Last Ship. I can't remember what.
So that's based on a book?
Yeah. William Brinkley wrote it. Okay. And so the original, here's something that some in your listenership will know. It's originally a nuclear war happened, and this is the last ship. In the show, of course, anyone familiar with the show, a biological pandemic has happened. Okay. And so there is a ship that was on deployment. It came back into the world, and this thing has already taken place. Mm. And so, but yeah, that was based on an old World War III type novel. There's even a Russian ship in it that, you know, they still want. And that's the thing about that nuclear fiction that I've explored a little bit too, is even after this war is over, if I see a Russian, Philip K. Dick does this too, in Second Variety. Russians and Americans are still angry at each other. Right. Even after they realize they've already destroyed the world, when they come up against each other, they still want to fight.
Right. Machines.
They've actually won the war. We didn't know it. So I think all those things are really neat. So Kim Stanley Robinson, those books that I mentioned there, Stand on Zanzibar, Second Variety by Philip K. Dick, which is actually a short story, but you can get a hold of it. It's a novelette, actually, but you can get a hold of it. William Brinkley's The Last Ship. And then there is a lot of YA dystopian that's based on predominantly climate change. It's not a personal interest of mine, but there is a lot of it out there.
Yeah. I was trying to think if there was anything that stuck out to me.
Yeah, I'm looking through. I've actually, in part of my process, I've started compiling kind of my personal master list of different types of dystopian and apocalyptic fiction. So yeah. Parable of the Sower, a lot of people don't really realize just how apocalyptic that is by Octavia Butler. That's an option that a lot of people are already familiar with. Mm-hmm. And then again, the Kim Stanley.
A couple of the Hugo winners that I'll recommend. Dream Snake by Vonda McIntyre is definitely, you don't know it right away that it's post-apocalyptic, but you find out that it is. And then Where Late the Sweet Birds Sang by Kate Wilhelm is another one that's like an enclave of people, a family that realizes things are about to go really bad. What do we need to do to maintain our own kind of heritage? And that's an interesting one because you get consequences of being so insular. And we're going to go this direction. Well, what if that direction's not the right way? And if you're going to suppress other methods of maintaining genetic diversity, for instance. So that's an interesting one as well.
Yeah, there's Stephen Baxter wrote a trilogy, and the one that I had read directly was, I think it's The Ark. The world is flooded, fully flooded. It's more than just the ice, the glaciers and whatnot.
The fountains melting, of the deep.
But it's, basically. And I don't actually know if I don't remember. It's been a while since I read it. I don't know that he actually explains exactly how all this, but the Rocky Mountains are underwater. So the world has become kind of a water world, right. Like what Kevin Costner explored in his movie back in the 90s. But at any rate, so they designed this ark, which is, apocalyptic in and of itself. The term ark, it's a spaceship that's going to get them to a new Earth, a new option for an Earth-like planet. And one of the key concepts in that you just mentioned is the maintaining genetic diversity. Yeah. How many humans do you need to make sure that we don't all end up, inbred lunatics by the time it's all done?
Yeah.
And so he deals a lot with that. So Stephen Baxter is another person I'd recommend on that, particularly the ark.
Cool.
Just really neat. There's just a lot of it out there, and it depends on what type flavor are you really most into. If you're kind of your generation, my generation, and maybe even before us boomers, the nuclear fiction is probably more our speed.
Sure.
Even though it's not necessarily the popular thing anymore.
Yeah.
Climate fiction, of course, is the main driver right now, I think.
Yeah.
And then, there was this time span at the end of the Cold War, early 90s, to kind of the early aughts where, we had a lot of alien takeover and a lot of robot takeover type fiction that I think was big. There was also, that was during the Left Behind series. So religious apocalypse was big during the 90s. So it just depends on what your personal flavor is of apocalypse to enjoy.
Well, and of course the zombie apocalypse, right?
Oh, yes, I forgot.
Zombie apocalypse and robot uprising are pretty similar. Especially a book like World War Z and a book like Robopocalypse, which are basically like mirror image of each other, where one of them is technological and the other is biological.
Yeah. Those are all fascinating to me, honestly. Yeah. I'm not a zombie guy myself, but I would be in a pickle if I was in a World War Z type situation. I would honestly probably not survive, to be honest with you, but I'm not Superman.
Right. I don't have weapons, so.
Yeah. And I don't have anything cool.
And my shoulders are bad. So baseball bat wouldn't do me that much good.
Yeah. My knees hurt after a while. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I got a boom arm for my podcast equipment. I guess I could swing at a couple of people, but throw my cell phone at somebody. Yeah. But, I'm not going to, that's the other thing about the apocalypse fiction. Of course, with nuclear, you don't have a choice anyway. You're either going to die or you're going to live.
Right.
You're going to die immediately or you're going to hope to survive the nuclear winter.
Right. It's the fast apocalypse followed by the slow apocalypse, right?
Yes, the slow apocalypse, which often allows for a blending. That's something else I'm finding as I kind of survey fiction is that there's a lot of novels that blend. Philip K. Dick's Second Variety, for example, is a nuclear fiction followed immediately by a robot uprising fiction, basically. So there, there's melding of these ideas. And then, of course, anytime you have something like a bioweapon, you're now going to have pestilence and famine and all that stuff, too. So there's so many ways to die. It reminds me of the Disturbed song, Just Another Way to Die. But we find lots of ways to do it as humans.
Yeah. Well, you'll have to keep me posted for as you make progress on the project. And I do want to invite anybody listening to this. I hope you enjoyed this discussion. This is a different thing than I typically do on the podcast. But you know, let us know, like, what are your favorite apocalyptic titles? And like, how do you answer the question of why do I like this? Why am I drawn to it? I'd be very curious to hear from folks.
I am also super curious about that. Please share that with me. Yeah. If anyone reaches out to you, and they can go to, you know, I assume at some point I'll mention my website.
I was just about to do that. Contact. Why don't you do it?
Yeah, there's a contact form on my website, www.coffeeinspacepodcast, just like it would seem it would say. It's all one word, coffeeinspacepodcast.com.
Cool.
And there's a contact thing on there, or comments@coffeeinspacepodcast.com. I am, you know, actively seeking research. And if you're an author that's written in this subgenre of science fiction, I'd love to hear from you too.
Yeah. Well, Dan, thanks for doing this. Thanks for inviting me on your podcast and then suggesting the idea, hey, while we're on the line, why don't we record one for you too?
Yeah, I think it's really cool.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
Cool. Well, cool. I'll let you know when this comes out and we'll, I'm sure, continue to talk down the line.
Sounds great, man. Right. Thanks.
It's good having you. Bye.
Yep.